Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Your regular financial contributions make it possible for Beth Emmanuel to make D. Thomas Lancaster's weekly sermons available online. We genuinely appreciate your support and hope that you are blessed by these teachings. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's extended virtual family and support our efforts for the kingdom with a gift by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Where did the first Christians go to church? Did they build a church there in Jerusalem? And if so, did it have a steeple and so on? These are nonsensical questions, of course. You know, these are nonsensical questions. You ask nonsensical questions, you get nonsensical answers. And our goal here at Beth Emmanuel is always to be sensical. So obviously, the first Christians were not Christians, as we understand the term today, that is to say they didn't practice Christianity, and that Christianity did not yet exist as an entity outside of Judaism. The first Christians were Jews. They practiced Judaism. They didn't go to church. They went to synagogue. On the other hand, they did have a common place of assembly in Jerusalem, a place where the Jewish believers in Jerusalem gathered every day for prayer and worship and teaching. It was called Solomon's Colonnade, or in some translations, Solomon's Portico, and in other translations, Solomon's Porch. I kind of like that one the best. It evokes images of rocking chairs and sipping lemonade and that sort of thing, sitting on Solomon's porch. But it wasn't a porch like that. Instead, it was a colonnaded courtyard consisting of a portico of monolithic white marble pillars covered over with cedar beams. And the portico ran along the eastern wall of the Temple Mount, so it was part of the temple courts. It was just opposite the Mount of Olives. When the Hasmoneans and Herod the Great expanded the Temple Mount, the Kidron Valley prevented them from expanding it on the east side. So the colonnade that faced the Mount of Olives marked the line of the original construction from King Solomon's time, and that's why the people called it Solomon's Colonnade. It stood above this original section of retaining wall out on the eastern side of the Temple Mount. So Josephus describes it this way. He says, these colonnades on the east, belonged to the outer court and were situated above a deep valley. And they had walls that reached 400 cubits built of square white stones. And the length of each stone was 20 cubits, the height was 6 cubits. This was the work of King Solomon, this is what Josephus says. So the apostolic community, anticipating the return of Messiah, would enter the temple from the east. They wanted to be the first to greet him, and they would wait for him to enter the temple from the east. And the eastern gate, you can see the eastern gate today. You look across from, you're on the Mount of Olives, you look across, you can see the eastern gate in the wall still. That great eastern gate it's called the Golden Gate, right? The Golden Gate probably preserves the location of the second temple's eastern gate. You know, just an interesting aside, the prophet Zechariah predicted, of course, that the Messiah will appear, he will arrive, his feet will set down on the Mount of Olives, and so he enters into the temple from the Mount of Olives. That's the Mount of Olives side, that's the eastern gate, Messiah's east gate. And Ezekiel saw a vision in which the divine presence, the Shekinah of God, entered the temple, returns to the temple through that same gate. And when the Muslims walled up the two portals of the eastern gate in the 9th century, Christians took note of the prophecy in Ezekiel that says, this gate shall be shut. It shall not be opened. No one shall enter by it, for the Lord God of Israel has entered by it. Therefore, it shall be shut. After the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 2, the disciples used Solomon's colonnade, the portico that was accessed through this gate, as their regular place of assembly. Is a pretty sweet spot, actually, because you had the Mount of Olives to the east, and directly to the west was the entrance to the temple. So it was prime real estate, I guess you could say, in the temple courts, and they would congregate there. Solomon's colonnade. It was the first church, Solomon's porch. Almost 2 decades ago, my father and my mother were visiting my wife and I at our home in St. Paul. And, of course, they were there to visit the grandbabies, especially. I think there were three of them at the time, you know. All boys. They were there to see the grandchildren. My father would always talk, and he'd talk with me. I remember on that particular visit, my father was talking about the book of Hebrews. I remember this conversation very clearly. He had been studying the epistle to the Hebrews on his own. Maybe he was teaching on it at the time, I don't know. But he was just sharing a few observations with me. He thought it strange that the writer of the book of Hebrews said in Hebrews 13:21, and we looked at this last week, when he said, "I have written to you only briefly." My father said, "Briefly?" It's a really long epistle. It's one of the longest epistles in the Bible, so this puzzled my father. And I remember he was sitting on the sofa, you know, maybe on the porch. No, we didn't have a porch. But if we had a porch, we'd be sitting on the porch. He was sitting on the sofa in our living room as he discussed this, and not that anyone had asked about the book of Hebrews, nor I hadn't, or anyone else. It's just that, you know, he liked to talk about the things that he likes to talk about, the things he's been studying, and, things he was looking into, something that I constantly do to my own sons as well. Not that I suppose they'll remember it and put it in a sermon 15 years later, but simply because I enjoy a captive audience, and I do to them what I do to you. So, my father, he was talking about the book of Hebrews, and he suggested that originally the book of Hebrews was sent as two separate documents, a long document that consisted of the main teaching of the epistle, and then a short letter attached to the document, which begins near the end of chapter 13. And our own studies last week supported that theory. Last week we saw that most of the epistle is not an epistle. It's a sermon, a word of exhortation, a teaching, originally intended to be delivered in a first century synagogue. In this case, a Greek-speaking messianic Jewish assembly. Only the closing remarks in chapter 13 can really be considered epistolatory in nature. That's not a word. I don't think it is. Epistolatory. But you get the idea. It communicates, and that's what's important. In the same conversation with my father, I have the same conversation with my father speculated about the occasion that inspired the writing of the book of Hebrews. He was just musing over it. He was mulling over it, you know, and I remember there, you know, sitting on the sofa, you know, and he said, "I think those Jewish Christians had been kicked out of the temple and they were at a loss and they didn't know what to do about it." This is just a statement he just threw out. And I have to credit my father with this interpretation because it would not have occurred to most Christian pastors. Most Christian pastors assume that the early Jewish Christians forsook the temple, forsook the priesthood and the Levitical system, and certainly the sacrifices from the outset, from the day of the resurrection of Jesus, or at least from the day of Pentecost. They would assume that the book of Hebrews is warning Jewish believers against backsliding into Judaism and into Jewish practice. That's the standard interpretation. They assume that the book of Hebrews warns Jewish Christians not to backslide into participation in the temple. This assumption is so much a part of the theological paradigm of Christian teaching that it almost goes without saying. Didn't Jesus teach against the temple? Didn't he say, "You'll worship me not on this mountain or in Jerusalem, but true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth"? Didn't he say that? Didn't he predict the destruction of the temple? Didn't his death replace the animal sacrifice? Wasn't he the final sacrifice? And from this perspective, the epistle of to the Hebrews is about the danger of a Christian Jew falling back into Judaism. So my father's suggestion turned that interpretation upside down. What if it was not a warning against backsliding into Judaism and into the temple, temple practice? What if it was a consolation to a confused and shaken community that had just been forcefully ejected from the temple and now is under pressure to renounce the name of the Master? These are my father's ideas. My father's suggestion has several advantages. First of all, it doesn't anachronistically imagine a developed Christianity and developed Christian identity that was outside of Judaism at the time. It does not call for Jesus abolishing the Torah or the Levitical system. It explains the arguments within the epistle very well, as we will see when we start to actually study the epistle. And it fits with what we know about the early believers and their relationship to the temple. And that's what we have to talk about today, the early believers and their relationship to the temple. What do we know about the early believers and their relationship to the temple? I've written on this subject. I've taught on this subject several times. If the material sounds familiar, it should. And honestly, I would prefer not to teach it. It makes me sad that I should have to say, that I should have to stand up here and state what should be obvious. But there are some things that cannot be overemphasized. The disciples of Yeshua revered the temple. They revered it because their master revered it. He regarded the temple not as a relic of the Old Testament economy, but he called it my Father's house. As a boy, Yeshua was reluctant to leave the temple courts. As an adult, he could be found in the temple teaching and attending the festival services. He spent the last days of his life, in fact, prior to the crucifixion, in the temple. He prophesied about the coming destruction of the temple only with sorrow and weeping. He drove the money changers from the courts. And as he did so, he quoted the prophet Isaiah saying, "My house shall be called a house of prayer." It's written, "My house shall be called a house of prayer." And then it says his disciples saw this and they remembered the passage that said, "Zeal for your house consumes me." He was zealous for the temple. And he promised to return to the temple when Jerusalem welcomes him with the words, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." The Gospel of Luke concludes, of course, with the ascension of the Master. And after the Master's ascension, it says that the disciples returned to Jerusalem and were continually in the temple praising God. That's the end of the Gospel of Luke. And they were in the temple, I think, perhaps in Solomon's colonnade, in Solomon's portico, right there on the porch, when the Holy Spirit was poured out on them on the day of Pentecost. And that day, the book of Acts says, they devoted themselves to the prayers, that is to the temple and synagogue liturgy, and that they were day by day, you know, day by day means every day, every day, attending the temple together. That's what it says, Acts 2:46. The temple became the center of the apostolic community. They attended the daily times of sacrifice. We learn in Acts chapter 3 that they participated in the prayer services. Acts chapter 5 says that every day the believers were all together in Solomon's portico and that the people held them in high esteem. And even when the Sanhedrin ordered them not to speak in the temple any longer, they persisted and they were arrested and an angel of the Lord rescued them and then said to them, "Go stand in the temple and speak to the people." They were like Anna the prophetess, of whom it says in Luke 2:37, "She did not depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer, night and day." That's Anna the prophetess who prophesied over the Master. They remained in the temple. It says in Acts 5:42, "Every day, and they continued to assemble in the name of Yeshua there." Perhaps because of their constant presence in the temple, we read, "A great many priests became obedient to the faith." So then we should ask, what did these priests do when they became believers? Did they quit? Did they turn in their resignation? Leave the priesthood? Did they say, "Sorry, can't be a priest anymore, because, you know, now I know that Yeshua is the only true sacrifice"? Of course not. They continued to minister according to the commandment that was upon them, according to their holy obligation, but now they did so with more conviction than ever. All these years, they have been splashing blood against the altar. Now, as they splashed the blood against the altar, they did so with spiritual insight. And they saw the blood of the Master that atones for us. So, We're commonly taught that, Christ hated the temple, the believers taught against the temple, and this sort of thing, and he was teaching against the temple. And it does say this in the Bible, but it says that these are lies. It says that these are lies. When false witnesses rise up against Stephen, they arrest him, and they tell lies about him. They charge him with speaking against the temple in the name of Yeshua. The book of Acts states this unequivocally, that the charges against Stephen, that he's speaking against the temple, that these are false allegations brought by false witnesses. And the high priest asks Stephen, he says, "Are these things so?" He's asking, "So have you been teaching? Did your master teach against the temple? Are you teaching against the temple?" And then Stephen takes a whole chapter to deny the charges. A whole chapter is right there. The Jewish believers in Jerusalem didn't build a church. This is my point. They didn't build a church or even a synagogue. There wasn't a synagogue of the believers in the first century because they were all about being in the temple. You've heard this before, I'm sure, but my theory of the name, the church, which is ekklesia in Greek, is that it's derived from their habit of assembling in the temple. Because ekklesia means assembly. It's the Greek word for assembly. The word you see translated as church in your Bible, it's ekklesia. But in the Hebrew scriptures, it's the equivalent of the kahal, which was typically referring to an assembly in the temple. So this could have happened quite naturally. You know, if the early Jerusalem believers were greeting one another, say, "Hey, I'll see you at the assembly. I'll see you at the ekklesia. I'll see you at the kahal." The name would just fit very quickly. So maybe that's where the whole idea of the church came from. The ekklesia, the kahal, the assembly in the temple. The believers in Jerusalem, we know, practiced communism of a sort, a communal type of living, selling their possessions, more like the Essenes than, Lenin or something like that, Lenin or Marx. But, they would sell their possessions and they'd hold everything in common. And this was a model, but if it was a model, then we should ask, should we do that? Why don't we do that? I don't see why you guys don't sell all your possessions and give me the money and I'll administer it. I think that's biblical. So why don't we do that? Well, why did they do that? Here's what we should be asking. Why did they do that? Why didn't any of Paul's congregations do that? Well, the answer is, why did they do that? The answer to why they did that is because the temple was in Jerusalem. Simon Peter didn't want to go back to Capernaum. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, didn't want to go back to Bethsaida. James, the brother of Yeshua, didn't want to go back to Nazareth. Nathanael didn't want to go back to Cana. The Greek-speaking Jews from the diaspora, from places like Cyprus and Alexandria, Egypt, wanted to remain in Jerusalem too, near to the temple, near to the apostles, near the Father's house. So Joseph Barnabas sells his property in Cyprus, moves to Jerusalem. Stephen moves to Jerusalem. Ananias and Sapphira sell their property, move to Jerusalem. The temple drew the apostolic community together. What about Paul? Paul comes along, he has an encounter with Yeshua on the way to Damascus, spends a couple years outside of the land of Israel. When he comes back, where does he go? He goes straight to the temple, and what does he do in the temple? He sees a vision of the Master. Yeshua appears to him, where? In the temple. So, and then we should say, regarding what do you, when you go to the temple, you pray, right? You pray, you worship God. What else do you do in the temple? Well, you hear some teaching, you do some teaching. Maybe we'll do some teaching in Solomon's Colonnade. What else do you do in the temple? Well, what about sacrifices? Did they bring sacrifices? This is where we should draw the line. I think this is where people would draw the line and say, no, they didn't bring sacrifices. But if they did not continue to participate in the sacrifices, as the theologically theologically, we assume that, of course, after the death of Jesus, they wouldn't be keeping the sacrifices. But if that was so, the Bible should say so. I mean, if you were to read this without any of the assumptions of theological training that you receive from Christianity about Jesus being the final sacrifice and that sort of thing, you just read this completely unclouded, you would expect that it would say, and they no longer kept the sacrifices. They no longer participate. It doesn't say this. Why doesn't it say this? This is a big omission. Are we just supposed to assume it? I mean, it's a big interruption. The Bible should have recorded a deviation from normative Jewish practice. It doesn't. If they had turned their backs on the Levitical system, the New Testament writers should have talked about it, because that would have been a really big deal and something that would have caused a lot of trouble for them with the rest of the Jewish community. Instead, the book of Acts notes that they continued to participate in the normal sacrificial services. 30 years after the death and resurrection of the Messiah, Paul goes to worship in Jerusalem to keep the festival of Pentecost, and he says to present sacrifices, to present offerings. That's Acts 24:17. And he joins four other believers who, like himself, had undergone Nazirite vows, and the five of them bring a whole host of sacrifices. You can read about it in the book of Numbers chapter 6, these narratives. And you're familiar with this. You're familiar with this material, but you know I think it's incredible. It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible oversight. Instead of James and the elders, the apostolic community, coming to Paul and saying, you know, Paul, we're concerned about people. You know, people have a bad opinion of you that you're no longer keeping Torah. You're no longer walking according to the commandments. You know, they come and they say, here's what you should do. Bring these sacrifices. You were going to pay for these guys' sacrifices and prove that you are kosher. Prove to who? Prove to the other Jewish believers that you yourself are walking according to the Torah, right? Right? So then Paul gets arrested. He defends himself before Festus, saying, hey, I only went up to worship in Jerusalem. Worship in Jerusalem means offer sacrifices. He says, I went to bring offerings. It's the Greek word means sacrifices, Acts 24:17. So, where does this leave us? Wasn't Jesus the final sacrifice? Hadn't Jesus already canceled the sacrifices through his sufficient death? Well, maybe, but no, the apostles apparently did not know that. Paul apparently did not know that. So this is what we're going to be learning in the book of Hebrews. We're going to figure out what's going on here. I mean, James, of all people, should have known that. Don't you think James, the guy who told Paul to bring these sacrifices, James, the head of all believers, second only to Jesus himself, constantly in the temple, on his knees in prayer. Here's what a Messianic Jewish historian named Hegesippus wrote about him in the second century. He says, James used to enter the sanctuary alone and was often found on his knees beseeching forgiveness for the people, so that his knees grew hard like a camel's from him continually bending them in worship of God, beseeching forgiveness for the people. If the death and resurrection of the Messiah had canceled the Levitical worship system, why did Paul bring sacrifices? Why did the apostles continue to assemble in the temple? Why did James continue to spend so many hours in the temple every day in prayer? So you start to get this picture. I'm just throwing this at you. I'm just throwing it at you. These people, our brothers and sisters, were a temple sect. And this applies not just to believers in Jerusalem and Judea, but to Jewish believers everywhere in those days. All the assemblies were planted by that mother congregation in Jerusalem. They all emulated the mother assembly in Jerusalem. They were all under the authority of James and the apostles in Jerusalem. And the Jewish believers from the diaspora congregations, whether they lived in Alexandria, Egypt, whether they lived in Antioch, Syrian Antioch, whether they lived in Rome, or any other place between, they came to Jerusalem for pilgrimage festivals. We read about that in Acts 2. It gives us a list of place names from which Jews traveled to keep the festivals all over the ancient world. They came from all over the world. Why did they come from all over the world? They came from all over the world because the temple was there. So it doesn't actually matter if the Epistle of the Hebrews was originally addressed to believers in Jerusalem, or if it was addressed to believers in Rome. The issues are the same. They all considered the temple to be geographically the center of their faith, and they all participated in the temple. Okay, that's a snapshot. I know I went really fast. That's a snapshot of the first Christians, right out of the box, right out of the Bible. Scrupulously Torah-observant Jews, devoted to the temple and its services, faithfully serving the Master. How far our theology has drifted from the early believers, from Paul, from James, from Stephen, from Peter, even from the writer of the book of Hebrews, that we need to waste a sermon trying to establish the continuity, the continuing validity of the temple in the lives of the first century believers. What would you like next? A sermon that the Pope is Catholic? It's sad, you know, it's sad. I hate to do it, but what I'm telling you right now is not taught. These are things you will not hear elsewhere outside of Messianic Judaism. Why? Because our theology traditionally comes with a heavy anti-Torah, anti-Jewish, anti-temple bias. Anti-temple is just a product of anti-Torah and anti-Jewish. They're all connected. It's all connected together. If we think of the believers as being anti-temple and anti-Torah, of course we're going to misread the New Testament. It's like trying to understand the Pope outside of the context of Roman Catholic Christianity. It's trying to understand, why does he wear that hat if he's a Baptist? It's backwards. Doesn't make sense. The sacrifices are in the Torah. The Torah says they are eternal statutes. That means they last forever. Well, as long as the world lasts. As long as heaven and earth endure, the Master would say. So either the Torah is right or the Torah is wrong. You got two options. The Torah is right, the Torah is wrong. And if it's wrong, we're out of business. Close up shop. And I'll go home early today. Call the whole thing off. So last week we determined that the book of Hebrews must have been written prior to the fall of the temple, we determined, prior to the fall of the temple. More than that, prior to the beginning of the Jewish revolt. More than that, prior to the beginning of the Neronian persecution in Rome. And based on those deductions that we made last week, we placed it in the early 60s of the first century, which were not nearly as groovy as the early 60s of the previous century. And that is significant. Because around the year 60, Paul's ship went down off Malta. You know that story? It's 60 Common Era. Big storm on the Mediterranean. Paul's ship goes down. Swims ashore. He's saved. Everybody on the ship saved. And around the year 62, Nero releases Paul from prison. Paul gets back on a ship. Sails for Spain. Peter arrives in Rome. And back in Judea, things come to a head between the Jewish believers and their arch enemies. Who are their arch enemies? The Sadducees. Sadducees. You gotta say it with a snarl. Sadducees. Like that. The Sadducees. The Sadducees who denied the resurrection. And who were responsible for so many persecutions against the disciples, who were responsible for the trial and the death of the Master. The wicked Rome collaborating Sadducean high priesthood that had control of the temple, illegitimate control of the temple, and they were always at odds with the Master and then with his disciples. And they couldn't stand the disciples because the disciples, the very fact that these people believed in a guy that had come back from the dead, was a big poke in the eye to people who made their primary theological premise that there is no such thing as a resurrection from the dead. And at that time, there was a Sadducean priest named Hanan ben Hanan. I kind of like saying it. Hanan ben Hanan. He was the son of Hananiah ben Seth, who we see in the Gospels under the name Annas, Annas of the Gospels. 32 years later, Hananiah ben Seth, Annas of the Gospels, collaborated with his son-in-law, Caiaphas, and the Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate, to put our Master to death. Same family as this Hanan ben Hanan. That was his dad, Hanan ben Hanan. And in the year 62, Festus, the Roman procurator Festus, died unexpectedly. Think he had a heart attack. Could have been a heart attack. I don't know. Could have choked on something. There's all sorts of ways he could have died. Doesn't matter. It was unexpected. You know him from Acts 24. Festus and Felix. Festus. He dies unexpectedly. And so Rome has to send a replacement. Before the replacement can get there, Hanan ben Hanan convenes an illegal assembly. An illegal Sanhedrin of Sadducees cuts out the Pharisees. And they arrested James, the brother of the master, and several other prominent believers. And they put James up on the pinnacles of the temple, as you know, overlooking the Kidron Valley. And they demanded that he renounce the name of the master, renounce the name of Yeshua. James refused. They threw him down. He survived the fall. His feet didn't strike against the stone. Then they stoned him. That didn't work either. So then a big guy with a big club came up and whacked him and killed him. Over the head. Fuller's club. Death of James. Death of James the righteous is more than just another martyrdom. This was the big one. James presided over the believing community, over the whole believing community. He was called the Nasi. That is the prince. He was the steward of the throne of David. He was the head elder. He was the bishop. He was the bishop of bishops. There's more to the story. The chief priests among the Sadducees conceived of a plan that would have dislodged the community. They came up with this fiendish plot to dislodge the community from their accustomed place of worship. So they go to King Agrippa. King Agrippa 2, not 1, 2. King Agrippa, son of King Agrippa. They go to King Agrippa with a building request. You've met King Agrippa. He was the guy in Acts 26 with his sister Bernice. Paul met them. Anyway, they go to King Agrippa. They need a building permit. They pointed out that the laborers working on the massive temple remodeling project that had first been instituted by King Agrippa's great-grandfather Herod the Great have finally completed the project. Look at these massive buildings, the master's disciples said. Look at these enormous buildings. The project was finally complete. It had been like 60 years. And the conclusion of the project left 18,000 unemployed laborers in Jerusalem. That's trouble. So they suggested, to keep these guys busy, a new phase to the project. They suggested that these laid-off workers could rebuild Solomon's colonnade from the valley floor all the way up and receive, they volunteered to put the money up themselves from the temple treasury to pay these guys. And of course, best of all, this would force, closed for remodeling, this would force the believers out of Solomon's colony. It's incredible coincidence that this happened, that this they made this, they wanted to do this right at the time of the death of James. Well, King Agrippa vetoed the plan. He rejected it. Here's what he said. He said, "It is easy to demolish a building, but not so easy to build it up again." What's amazing to me is that he uttered these words just a year or so before the Jewish revolt began. In retrospect, his words sound prophetic. And they compare with the master saying, "Destroy this temple. In 3 days, I will build it up again." I didn't really know any of this back when my father was discussing the book of Hebrews, and neither did he. But everything I have told you is the real story. It's the real apostolic story. It's apostolic history. Now I'm coming to the speculative part. And by speculative, we don't know for sure part. The part that my father suggested as the key to interpreting the epistle to the Hebrews. It seems to me that when their plan to remodel Solomon's colonnade and thereby oust the believers from their accustomed roost in the temple failed, the Sadducean chief priests including Hanan ben Hanan, seem to have used their authority to simply ban the disciples from participation in the temple at all. We can infer this development from the contents of the epistle, where the readership seems to be facing mounting social pressure to renounce their faith in the Master. And the epistle frequently enjoins those readers not to shrink back, not to let go, but to hold fast to their faith in Yeshua. And we saw the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews chapter 11, the book of faith and hope, where it provides examples of biblical heroes who persevered in faith despite their circumstances, and it exhorts readers to stand fast with the same conviction. The writer tells the Jewish believers, consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And he reminded them of the days when they suffered under the persecutions, the early persecution, like the persecution under that was associated with the stoning of Stephen, the first martyr. He says in Hebrews 10, but recall the former days when after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, sometimes being partners with those so treated, for you had compassion on those in prison. You joyfully accepted the plundering of your property. This is talking about the early days. Since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. So don't throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. I'm speculating a little bit here, but it appears to me that given the situation, given the circumstances that we're building around this epistle, that the Sadducean priestly leadership assigned the believers with a status that we know from the Torah called karet. Karet means cut off from Israel. In other words, they put them on the ban. And the ban remained in effect only so long as they clung to their confession of the Master. To return to fellowship within the temple, all that they needed to do was renounce their faith in the crucified one. Our Master had foreseen this. He predicted this. He said in John 16:2, they will put you out of the assembly. They will put you out of the assembly. Banned from the assembly. Banned from the kahal. Some of the believers in Jerusalem despaired. They despaired of assembling together at all. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews says, let's hold fast to the confession without wavering and not neglecting to assemble together, as some are in the habit of doing. So that's my father's theory in the book of Hebrews. And I think he's right. I believe this is the issue, the occasion that inspired the composition of this word of exhortation that we call the Epistle to the Hebrews. The believers had been put out of the assembly. How can they be readmitted? How can we get back into the temple? That's what they want to know. How can they get their library card restored? How do they get their temple privileges resumed? As in the story of the martyrdom of James, all that they needed to do was renounce their faith in Yeshua of Nazareth. And now, then, okay, all right, now we're ready to start studying the book of Hebrews. And with God's help, we'll do that next week or something like that. Until then, you know, I'm going to turn your heart toward Messianic Jerusalem, out of which Messiah himself will one day rule as king. In that day, many nations will say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. What is the mountain of the Lord? It sounds good when Paul Wilbur says it, but what is the mountain of the Lord? It's the Temple Mount. That's the Temple Mount. And it says, they'll say, let us go up to the house of the God of Jacob. What is the house of the God of Jacob? That is the Holy Temple. It's the temple of the Lord, the house of the God of Israel. the house of the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, Yeshua, our righteous Messiah.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.